From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. You might have a little more time to prepare your federal income taxes if the Trump administration decides to push off the traditional April 15th deadline as acknowledgement that the coronavirus may be affecting some Americans' abilities to file. Still, eventually, most will have to do so, and there's a lot nuke to consider this year. Today in The Exchange, what you need to know as you tackle your taxes. But first, a New England perspective on several dramatic announcements this week. First, the World Health Organization's naming the coronavirus a pandemic. And second, the governors of three New England states declaring states of emergency. From the Boston Globe, Felice Fryer joins us. She's a health reporter there. And Felice, thank you very much. A lot is happening very quickly. We really appreciate you keeping us up to date and welcome.
Well, thank you. Good morning.
Well, and first off, the World Health Organization, Felice, declaring this a pandemic. What is the official definition of a pandemic?
So I don't think the WHO actually has an official definition. The dictionary definition is that it's an epidemic that is spread over several countries or continents, usually affecting a large number of people.
So how significant is this declaration, Felice?
It's not. In a practical sense, it really doesn't mean that much. I mean, the WHO was emphatic that the pandemic declaration doesn't change its assessment of the threat, doesn't change what the WHO is doing or what individual countries have been doing. So it's more of, I think it's a public relations effect, I guess. It's more of an emotional effect on the world saying, hey, this is very serious.
That's really interesting. So even though it does sound very serious, it certainly made me say, whoa, this is a huge deal. But in terms of details, Felice, it's not that significant?
Well, many public health experts have been calling it a pandemic for a long time.
I see.
So it's been a serious situation for a long time. And now the WHO is saying, yep, it's really serious.
Was there any hesitation, Felice, among health officials to adopt this sort of scary-sounding word?
Well, the WHO was worried that nations would conclude, we're all doomed, there's nothing we can do. So they held off on using the word in the hope that people would really react strongly to try to contain the virus.
Okay. And do you think it worked? It sounds like it is.
That, people are stepping up.
Let's talk about some of those stepped-up measures, Felice. Dr. Anthony Fauci, I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Yes,
director,
that's right.
Yeah, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, spoke this week on Capitol Hill. So speaking of taking dramatic measures, what measures did Dr. Fauci recommend?
He said that all public gatherings should be banned.
All? Okay,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Pretty strong recommendation.
What types of public gatherings are we talking about?
What you're seeing happening, a lot of conferences, concerts, marathons, wherever you have a lot of people together in a place, there's a risk of transmission of the disease.
Is there a number put to that word large? Is it 25 or more, I think I saw, or are officials leaving it for people to define what themselves large gatherings is?
Yeah, I think people are defining on their own. I know the governor of Rhode Island said 250 as her number. I spoke with a public health expert who said really no more than 25 people if you're talking about an enclosed space.
Wow.
So, yeah, nobody knows. You know, the more people you have together, the greater likelihood it is that they will share some germs.
Wow. Well, this week you mentioned the governor of Rhode Island. Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker declared a state of emergency, Felice. As you know, what does that mean for residents of Massachusetts, including yourself?
It doesn't have a dramatic practical effect. What it does is it gives the Baker administration some flexibility so they can quickly find space to stockpile supplies if they need be. The governor has the power to cancel events if he needs to do that. But I think, again, it has an important psychological effect. And as part of this, Baker said that in his own administration, he would not allow executive branch employees to go to conferences. And since then, we're seeing more and more conferences being canceled. We're seeing many companies telling their employees to stay at home, which is also what he recommended.
Wow. Well, New Hampshire has 100,000 residents who commute to your state every day. Any idea what it might mean for them, Felice?
Well, for starters, their commute's going to get a lot easier.
Right.
There are a few people on the roads, there are a few people on the trains. I come from the south. I took the train yesterday. The parking lot was half empty. The train was half empty. And I'm thinking, wow, this is really nice, but why am I doing this when no one else is?
Right.
So, you know, I think people are going to find that many, more and more companies, if they work in Massachusetts, their companies are going to be advising that they stay home.
What struck you, Felice, as a health reporter, again, who's been covering this, about the president's travel restrictions just announced last night on many Europeans, starting on Friday, lasting a month, he said?
Yeah, that was some surprising move. And I haven't interviewed anybody today, but just based on what I saw on Twitter, public health experts are calling this a classic case of closing the barn door after the horse is out. I mean, the illness is already here in the U.S. I'm not sure what's going to be accomplished by preventing more people from coming here. We had two people from Italy at a leadership meeting of a major biotech company, and there were only 175 people at the meeting, and about half of them are already infected with coronavirus. So it's here.
Wow. Highly contagious, too. Just hearing you tell that story shows me how easily you can get this.
Yeah, right. These people were just like sitting across the table from each other.
So Americans can come home from Europe on this ban. This is a ban on Europeans, not Americans coming home from Europe. Because it does kind of make me wonder, you know, an American in Europe could just as easily have this as a European in Europe. What are health officials saying about the health benefits of this ban on Europeans?
Well, when you say health officials, that sounds like government officials.
Sure.
I just know that the academic experts are saying that it's not likely to make a difference.
I want to ask you a couple more questions, Felice, and you've been really generous with your time. I know you must be just overwhelmed trying to keep up on everything.
Yeah.
A couple weeks ago, very few people were being tested. Who's being tested now, Felice? And just as important, who isn't?
It's still very few. So I'm reading in the New York Times that the CDC says about 8,500 specimens have been taken since the beginning of the outbreak, but many of those have not. The tests haven't been completed. But meanwhile, in South Korea, they're testing about 10,000 people a day.
Wow.
And so the U.S. is really behind on testing.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if this is as contagious as everybody says it is. If it is a pandemic, as the WHO says it is, why isn't everybody being tested? Is it just there aren't enough kits or there aren't enough
people? Right, yeah, the U.S. has just been very, it's a long convoluted story and some of it is a bit mysterious, but the U.S. has been very slow to respond on the testing issue, which is really critical. And right now, yeah, there are not enough test kits available. The capacity to test is way below what is needed.
Well, you hinted at this before, Felice, but I'll ask you straight up. The Boston Marathon coming up in April, a beloved institution, of course, in Massachusetts, but also around New England. Do we know anything yet?
Officially, the last I heard, the race is still on, but that could change. So check your news alerts.
Okay. Felice, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
That's Felice Fryer, again, health reporter for the Boston Globe. For the rest of the hour, we will be talking about taxes and what is new this year. It's the second year Americans will be filing under the major tax overhaul law of 2017. We have three guests in studio. Lynn Ford is here, Vice President and Wealth Manager at the Charter Trust Company. Lynn, welcome. Nice to meet you. Thank you for
Thank
being
you.
Here. Also with us, Carrie Gladstone, Senior Director of Asset Building Strategies at Granite United Way. Carrie, welcome back. Thanks
Thank
a lot.
You. Thank you, Laura. Good to be with you.
And also with us, Barbara Hege, Coordinator and Staff Attorney of the Low Income Taxpayer Project. And Barbara, good to see you. Thank you for your time as well.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, and we just heard from Felice about coronavirus. There was some conflicting news, Barbara, yesterday about whether the April 15th deadline might be put off for coronavirus. So what have you heard?
What I heard last night is that the deadline for payment of any tax due will be postponed for, quote, certain individuals and businesses. We don't know yet who those certain individuals and businesses are. I'm sure we'll be finding out very soon, because I'm guessing I'm not the only person to wonder, am I one of those certain individuals?
Sure.
I don't know. But I think it's important to keep in mind that there are always two deadlines on April 15 with the IRS. One is the filing deadline. That's when you need to get your tax return to the IRS. But there's also the payment deadline. And for filing your tax return, if you need a few extra months, you can get that automatically just by filing a request for an extension for 6 months. But that has never been a postponement of the deadline for paying your taxes. And there are separate penalties for these two deadlines if you don't meet them. And so having a possible extension of the payment deadline is huge. I don't know when it was ever done before.
You know what I don't understand about that, and I've heard others say what you said, Barbara, is if you can automatically get a couple extra months to follow the forms and stuff, but you don't automatically get extra time to pay. But how do you know how much you have to pay if you haven't done the paperwork?
That's a really good question. And I don't have a very good answer for that, other than you need to estimate as best as possible. Most people will realize, oh, you know, if I'm going to have a decent estimate, I might as well just get my tax return done. But for others, it really is better for them overall to wait and just give a good estimate. And the IRS doesn't slap a penalty for paying late if you're a few dollars or even a few $100 off of what you're supposed to pay. It's only if you're majorly wrong that you have an underpayment penalty.
Sure. Thank you for clearing that up. Something I always wondered about. Carrie, what are some of the factors that might be considered here about why people would get an extension on filing and paying?
Well, it might be a hardship case. We were hearing about people who may be forced to stay home. And one of the other pieces that's being discussed, including in the Congress possibly today, is what about people who are hourly workers? Will they get some support if they're going to be forced to stay home because their business is closed? And are they able to make their financial obligations, including their tax obligations?
So the idea is that people are just struggling overall with all the uncertainty. So let's just give everybody a break. That's what's being considered anyway, Carrie.
Well, as Barbara mentioned, it's certain individuals, and we don't know what parameters will be meeting the definition of certain. Because certain is uncertain.
Yeah, well, and there's a lot of uncertainty. Lynn, what else might be sort of at work here in terms of making this determination that, yeah, let's give folks a little more time?
Well, I think that it's really going to come down to how far spread the quarantines end up being over the next couple of weeks, because people sometimes typically wait until late to file because they're not sure if they're going to have to pay in or get a refund. So it's really going to depend on what happens over the next couple of weeks, I think, as to how far spread it becomes. Because at this point, it could be certain individuals where it just says if you were under a mandatory quarantine and can prove it, you're fine. But then if it becomes that this whole city of Boston is under quarantine, they might say, you know, it's kind of more widespread, so we might want to just encompass everybody.
Sure. And if you had a plan to meet with your tax preparer, you wouldn't be able to do that. And sometimes
Correct.
You do need a face-to-face meeting, right? You have to hand over
yep.
physical
and you need
paper
to sign
documents.
The paperwork. You need to get them all of the information. They might have questions that you have to answer that you need the paper in front of you that they have to be able to answer that. There's a lot of working pieces
yeah.
to it.
And not everyone can do this online.
Correct.
There's a lot of face-to-face interactions.
Correct,
still.
Especially if you have small business tax returns that you have to do, or the more complex returns. You can't necessarily do it online.
Yeah. Carrie, do you want to jump in there, too, about the importance of face-to-face meetings for people when it comes to getting everything done properly?
Sure. And we work with people at the lower end of the economic scale, low and moderate income people, through a program called VITA, the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, which has locations throughout New Hampshire. And in fact, with our partners at AARP, about 60 places operating in New Hampshire right now where people can get their taxes done face-to-face, prepared by IRS-certified volunteers. And that can not only help get the return completed accurately and on time, but can help the tax filer get a better understanding of what this thing called the tax return is all about. So, for example, we encourage people who may think they have to pay in to file early because it will give them a better understanding of the fact that this is how much it costs, that you file the return, get that out of the way. You do have until April 15th to pay. So you're differentiating between those two things, and it allows people to figure out how much they can pay right now, because any interest and penalties on that unpaid balance accrue after April 15th. So if they can pay that down, they can work out a payment plan. And, you know, it's complicated. And so we can help explain that to our filers.
Barbara, go ahead. Yeah.
Laura, this brings up an issue that Carrie and I see a lot, and that's the digital divide that we see.
I was going to ask you about that.
So
yeah,
many
ahead.
Of our low-income clients, they don't have internet access. They might not even have a smartphone. Or they are just not capable of using that technology. They need a face-to-face meeting with a tax professional. And I'm a little concerned about the VITA program over the next few weeks. There's been absolutely no announcement that would make people worry. But, of course, we do start to think about these things. I volunteer at a site in Concord on Saturday mornings, and the people who come to me don't have another good option.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point, so I'm glad you made it. It's so easy to say, well, just do it online. But, you know, as Lynn pointed out, there are forms that need to be physically signed sometimes in some instances. And you're right, for a lot of people, it's not obvious how to get online and do this, and they may not even have online access. So I think that's a really important point. I want to turn to this year's filing season and what is different this year. But before I do want to ask you, Lynn, what were lessons learned from last year when Americans were filing for the first time under that big Tax Cut and Jobs Act, which was basically the huge tax code overhaul law signed in 2017?
I think one of the biggest things was just the importance of reviewing your W-4 with your employer every year and why it's important. A lot of people struggled to understand that they were getting a smaller refund back, but they didn't understand they didn't pay in as much either. So that they immediately equate that to I'm paying more in taxes, not that my employer withheld less. And a lot of people just don't realize that. And it's extremely important to fill out your W-4 correctly if you want to be one of those people that don't want to pay in and don't want a huge refund. And the new W-4 is very cumbersome to figure out. It used to
really?
Be... Yes, it used to be very simple. You just figure out how many dependents you have, and then if you wanted any extra or if you were subject to any backup withholding, and that was what they would use to calculate. And now it's this big, you need to almost have your last year's tax return and your current pay stub with you to fill it out.
So, because that was the narrative from last year, is a lot of people said, hey, where's that big return I always get?
Yeah.
And then the administration said, well, okay, hang on. You actually paid less over the months of this
right.
past year, but didn't feel that way.
No,
so that was the big narrative from last year. I want to talk more about that W-4 and some of the complexities in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Carrie, go ahead. I can see you want to jump in.
Well, just in terms of what Lynn was saying, in terms of the W-4 and understanding withholding, when the new tax rates went into effect a year ago, there were people who were getting, and we talked about this on the air previously, people were getting more in their paycheck, but it might not have been enough to make them even realize. So all other things being equal, if they were getting $10 more per weekly paycheck, that was $500 more they had over the course of the year. Next thing they know, it's tax time, and dude, where's my refund? You know, their refund has gone down by $500, and it's, as Lynn said, you need to understand this new W-4 because you can no longer claim yourself or your children as a dependent. That doesn't come into play anymore. And so people were asked to do what the IRS called a paycheck checkup. That's about as witty as it gets at the IRS.
It's not bad.
Right. But there is a tool online on their surprisingly user-friendly website called the Withholding Estimator, where you can take a look at this new W-4. And a friend of mine who does workforce development helps people with this called me and said, where do I put my ones and my zeros?
Mm.
Well, you don't anymore. But the new W-4 does require a more accurate assessment of your overall picture. And the withholding estimator is an online tool that people can use to go through several screens and figure out, it takes into account if there's more than one job in the household, if there are certain tax credits that they may qualify for that would offset the need to have as much withheld. So that can be a helpful guide in having an accurate amount of withholding throughout the year.
For those people who have online access and sort of have the capacity and the comfort level to get online and do that, although they can come see you, Carrie, or you, Barbara, and your organizations if they do need help. Go ahead, Barbara.
I was going to jump in on that withholding estimator. Here's another line we can use. Don't you be a procrastinator. Use the withholding estimator.
Ooh, pretty good, Barbara.
And some people are saying that it's almost as complicated to fill out as a tax return, but it is pretty darn accurate. So if you can use it yourself or you get help from someone who does have access to the internet, it can really help you get down to exactly what you want to have for a refund. Some people want to have a forced savings account where they're giving the federal government an interest-free loan and have a nice big refund. And if that's what you prefer, you can do that and you can figure out how much it's going to be with the withholding estimator.
I thought part of the goal with this big tax overhaul was, one, to lower taxes, but two, to make things easier. But it doesn't sound that way.
Not really.
I mean, if just the withholding form is more complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It would take a lot to simplify the tax code so that Carrie and I would be out of jobs and maybe Lynn too.
I think one thing it did for folks of a certain income who were previously itemizing is that there are these items that you're allowed to claim, and if they add up to more than what's called the standard deduction, then you don't need to itemize, or you do itemize rather. With the increase nearly doubling the standard deduction, for example, a married couple filing a return together gets the first $24,400 tax-free.
It's a big change.
Right. So if their items add up to less than that, they can simply take the standard deduction, not have to sit at the kitchen table adding up all the receipts for charitable contributions and their mortgage interest and other things that are still available, but only above a certain amount.
All right. Well, coming up, a lot more on taxes this year as the annual filing deadline approaches. We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we've been covering dramatic, fast-moving news about coronavirus and the response, especially here in New England. We talked earlier with the Boston Globe's health reporter about the pandemic announcement from the World Health Organization and the states of emergency declared in three southern New England states. Now, we're talking about taxes, whether the April 15th tax deadline will be moved for some due to coronavirus. Also, we've been talking about lingering confusion from last year when Americans filed for the first time under the new tax law called the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Call in 1-800-892-6477 with your questions about changes in the tax code, what they might mean for you. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Lynn Ford, Vice President and Wealth Manager at the Charter Trust Company, Carrie Gladstone, Senior Director of Asset Building Strategies at Granite United Way, and Barbara Heggie. She's Coordinator and Staff Attorney of the Low Income Taxpayer Project. And all of you, just before the break, we were talking about some of the confusion from last year. People didn't do their withholdings right, so some of them got stuck with a bigger tax bill than they expected. They usually got refunds. They ended up having to pay. Now the withholding form has been changed, as you all told us. It's more complicated, but a lot more accurate. I think to you first, Lynn, what about itemizing? Another key message from last year was to most people, don't bother to itemize because that standard deduction is so much bigger. How possible is it that some folks could still benefit from itemizing, but they're not going to bother to look, given all the messaging that we're hearing?
Well, this circles back around to our earlier conversation about how important it is to meet in person with your tax professional, because you might actually be a little bit above the standard deduction, which means that it is beneficial for you to take it, even if you are at the point where you're kind of, I don't want to be bothered with it.
It really is a big hassle.
It is a big hassle. And in addition to changing the W-4 form, they also changed the 1040 form.
So just to back up, W-4 again is the withholding.
It's the withholding. Yep. And 1040 is the form you actually use to file your tax return. And they tried to make it simpler because most people will file the standard deduction and it's just the two-page form. Now you sign it and send it. But then when you have people who are filing business tax returns or the standard deduction or the itemized deduction, you actually have now, instead of just a front and back page form with a couple of schedules, they've broken it out. So now you end up with like this 20-page document that you're filling out and submitting because everything's a half a page. And it's a little more complicated, which again circles back around to why it's important to sit down with your tax professional.
Yeah. And as we discussed earlier, hopefully people will still be able to do that.
Yes.
We don't know. Things are changing by the minute. Go ahead, Carrie.
And Laura, from the nonprofit organization's perspective, you know, as we sit here during a pledge drive, your charitable contribution to NHPR is tax deductible. Only if you itemize. So that's part of that list of things that you itemize. So at Granite United Way, we and others have been advocating for separating that out and making what we call an above the line, a separate deduction that would be right on the 1040 for charitable contributions.
Is that still possible?
It is still possible. There's a couple of measures in the Congress right now that are looking for co-sponsors to say, let's call this the Universal Charitable Deduction Act, where you can, as, for example, people who have student loans and they're paying their student loans back, they can get a deduction for their student loan interest paid even if they're not itemizing. And there are several other what are called adjustments that can be added on even if you don't have enough items to itemize.
I see. So sort of popular items that were wiped off the table for most folks, given the huge increase in the standard deduction. But I'm not clear, Carrie, are you saying these are proposals in Congress, or are you saying I'm going to see these on my tax form when I finally knuckle down and start doing it?
So right now there are several items called adjustments that do exist. And I mentioned the student loan interest deduction. If you put money into an IRA, that's also something you can deduct, even if you're not itemizing. The charitable contributions would have to be an act of Congress to make that further change. And, you know, we saw major changes through the Act of Congress of 2017 that we're just getting caught up on right now. I mean, there were several pieces of legislation that expired that just kind of got left on the table. And then Congress late last year passed another big spending package that included what are called extenders. So they extended things like the tax credit for making energy improvements to your home. So if you put in new storm windows, a new hot water heater, or made other energy improvements to your home, you were able to take a contribution, actually get a credit for that paid directly against your taxes. However, that expired at the end of 2017. It was reinstated retroactively to the beginning of 2018. So if you haven't yet filed your 2019 return and you did make those energy improvements in 2019, as I did and was able to claim, but if you filed in 2018, having made those energy improvements,
sure,
you better still have the receipt. You can make an amendment to the 2018 return that you already filed, but it just adds to those complexities within the tax code.
So again, just to make it crystal clear, and please correct me if I'm wrong, so when the standard deduction was increased by a major amount, a lot of people said, I'm not going to itemize anymore, including these things that people really did like to, you know, include, such as student loan payments and other expenses. You're saying, Carrie, some of those are available still?
Yes.
Not all of them, but some of them.
Correct.
Okay.
So student loan interest was always part of it. I mentioned the one for energy improvements,
right.
and there were a couple of other pieces. Oh, tuition and fees deduction had expired, and now that's back, again, retroactive to 2018. 18. So any and it allows people to claim that, compare it to a tax credit, which is different from a deduction in that deduction reduces your taxable income, so your tax bill is smaller. The tax credit pays the bill directly. So people can compare these education tax credits to the tuition and fees deduction and see which is more beneficial.
Okay. I think I got it. Go ahead, Barbara.
Yes, there's another new adjustment that might affect a whole bunch of people that is going into effect for 2019, and that is the treatment of alimony. So it used to be that if you paid alimony, you could lower your taxable income without even thinking about whether you itemize or not. So very helpful to lowering your taxable income. And if you received alimony, you had to include that in your taxable income. But for all orders from family courts starting in 2019 or modifications in 2019 that specifically invoke this, the alimony is no longer includable as income to the person who gets it, and it's no longer an adjustment. It no longer lowers your taxable income for those who pay it.
What's the thinking behind that?
I'm hoping it's just to make things simpler. That would be really the biggest appeal.
All right. Again, I invite listeners to join us with their questions and comments. If you're wondering about some of the changes made to the tax code last year or the year before in that big tax overhaul law that passed in 2017 called the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, there's some lingering confusion from that law, and there's some changes this year, as we're hearing. We invite your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. So all of you, and Lynn, I'll start with you first again. What groups of people might especially be wanting to pay attention for changes this year? You know, age groups, people in certain stages of life, people who own certain types of businesses. Who's especially needing to pay attention this year?
So the short answer is everybody, because it does affect everybody.
Right.
But it's specifically people who have had job changes, people who maybe lost a job throughout the year or gained a better paying job throughout the year, people who had a really, really good year for their business when they might not necessarily have had good prior years because the economy until the last couple of days was actually doing really well and it was bolstering quite effectively. You also just have elderly people who have retired. Maybe they worked a little bit longer past their full retirement age, and now they've decided, you know, I'm not going to deal with this anymore. I'm going to retire. So their income has changed significantly. Anybody who's had a significant change in income, also people who have had adoptions and births in the family because now they have different dependents, people who have successfully launched their children and no longer have dependents. So there's, like I said, it really applies to everybody.
But especially those of us going through sort of major life events,
yes.
You know, the usual births, deaths, yep. Job changes,
I don't really
retirement
think it's an
status.
Age-specific thing. I think
sure.
It's a situation-specific. So.
Sure, that makes sense. What are you hearing? What sorts of concerns are you hearing from the people you work with, Lynn? Or questions, them coming in saying, whoa, I really don't get this.
Most of the questions that I get right now are about the market in general and people who are I'm looking to retire in the next couple of years. Can I still do that? And kind of talking people off the ledge, so to speak, to say, calm down. You've been working with us for a long time. We've strategically positioned you to the point where you can still move forward with what your plans are. And here's why. So that's most of what I deal with in the current environment.
So they're worried about their investments, less so about their taxes, or are there changes in tax status towards those investments that help people retire more comfortably?
So there aren't very many changes in the tax status on the investment side so much. Some of them might find themselves in a different tax bracket because they don't have dependents anymore and they don't have the itemized deduction. They have the standard deduction and some of the other stuff that was taken away. Some of them are getting a little creative with the charitable deductions that they do. Instead of getting the deduction, if you're over 70 and a half and you have to take money from your IRA, you can actually use your IRA to do the charitable gifting. directly, and then it doesn't count as income to you. You don't get a deduction, but it doesn't count as income because it's going directly to the charity. So there's a number of different ways that you can kind of work around the new tax system as long as you work with the professionals and you're not doing anything shady. As long as there are certain things that the IRS has allowed you to do to kind of navigate the new rules.
Well, we got an email from Allison in Ossipee who says, I am deeply confused by changes to home office deductions. I work from home exclusively. 2 years ago, I could deduct a portion of my square footage, utilities, non-reimbursed supplies, etc. Last year, I was told home office deductions were no longer allowed. And this year, there are oodles of confusing articles indicating that maybe they are again. Allison says, any clarity is appreciated. Allison, thank you so much for writing. Anybody want to jump in on this? I was reading about this yesterday, and it does seem like it changed, and then it changed again. Go ahead, Barbara.
My understanding is that if you are self-employed, it still applies. You can still take a deduction from your business income for having a home office if the space is used exclusively for business. But if you're an employee and you're trying to deduct unreimbursed employee expenses, it's a different matter. Lynn, Carrie?
Well, the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program that we run with the support of the IRS is really designed for simpler returns. So that's not a piece that even comes into play. We can do self-employed returns for certain folks, and the use of the home deduction is actually out of the scope of what we're able to do. So, we really can't offer a lot of guidance in that other than to say, we can help people understand what are the tax deductions that they can claim against the business. So we do see people coming in who are very skilled at carpentry or childcare or whatever the side gig, and they can do that well, but they don't really understand the business side of that. And so to be able to say, there are these resources, here's the form. It's called a Schedule C. You'll note these expense areas. So if you bought business cards or you paid for advertising or you had office supplies, you can separate those receipts into the appropriate categories and claim legitimate business deductions that can help you in a number of ways, understanding how to be a better business person for one thing. And it may also impact things like the earned income tax credit, which is a benefit for working people who don't make a lot of money. And by working, we mean either income from working for someone else or self-employment. And we can talk a little bit more about that because the IRS says there are many people who are eligible for that credit who don't claim it. And it leaves, by our estimation of IRS data, more than $30 million in money that could be going to the pockets of the most in need working people unclaimed, and that money just goes away.
All right. And we should talk about the earned income tax credit a little bit more because you're right. There are a lot of people who don't take it. Allison, I don't know if we helped. Good luck to you. I understand what you're talking about. I was reading up on it yesterday, and I'm hoping that she can find someone, who can help her out with this question. It sounds like that's another instance where you need one of those face-to-face interactions with someone.
And Laura, we refer people to the New Hampshire Society of Certified Public Accountants, which is a nonprofit organization to help with the professional development of accountants. And there's a Find a CPA function that you can either call the society or go onto their website and shop around, find someone. And depending on the income level, you can say, this is my situation. Can you help me understand this and kind of plead your case for this is how much revenue I'm expecting?
Allison, good luck to you. You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Go ahead, Barbara.
Laura, I want to mention that there are also enrolled agents who are accountants who have passed very rigorous tests with the IRS to become certified as people who can represent clients before the Internal Revenue Service. And they're another excellent option for getting help during the tax season and beyond. And there is a Northern New England Society of Enrolled Agents that people can look up to get good recommendations.
Well, I'm glad she mentioned businesses because, again, that's a whole bunch of people right here in New Hampshire. We're very entrepreneurial state. We have a lot of people who have
home businesses and so forth. You mentioned earlier, Lynn, retirees, people approaching retirement or in retirement right now. And you also touched on a couple changes that are at stake for this group, including IRAs and how those are managed. I'm wondering how to discuss this without getting too much detail, but just to let folks know that there have been some major changes in terms of how their retirement income is taxed.
Giving a 50,000 foot view,
sure.
They passed at the 11th hour in the big spending bill for 2019 changes for the 2020 tax year and forward for retirement savings. There were a bunch of different things that they have done, but some of the most significant ones that affect most people, not just retirees, is it used to be you were not eligible to contribute to a company's 401k plan if you worked less than 1,000 hours a year. What this change has done is it has actually made it so if you work at least 500 hours a year for 3 years consecutively, you are now eligible to participate in the 401k plans that your employer has out there for you.
So part-timers can participate.
So part-timers can participate if they meet that 500 hours mm-hmm. minimum for 3 consecutive years. That's a huge change because there have been a lot of part-time employees that have never been eligible for the plan, and that was federal regulation, not the employer regulation. So the only other major change that really affects taxability is you can now make contributions to IRA accounts even if you're over 70 and a half, and they are tax deductible as long as you have earned income. So if you're over 70 and you're still working, you can contribute to IRAs now and have it be tax deductible.
Okay, and with the stock market crash, there's probably a lot of 69-year-olds who are wondering whether they can retire now and might want to keep working for a little while. So lots more to talk about in just a moment. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's a quick check-in on filing your taxes this year. We're finding out that there are a lot of changes in store. Let's get your questions and comments in at 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Lynn Ford, Vice President and Wealth Manager at the Charter Trust Company, Carrie Gladstone, Senior Director of Asset Building Strategies at Granite United Way, and Barbara Hege, Coordinator and Staff Attorney of the Low Income Taxpayer Project. And it's so great to have all of you here because you all kind of cover different aspects of this topic. And Barbara, I wanted to ask you first. So the Low Income Taxpayer Project, who is coming to you and what are some of the basic problems that they're having?
Oh, thanks, Laura. The Low Income Taxpayer Project is part of the New Hampshire pro bono referral system. And the tax clinic helps people who have problems with the IRS after they have filed a return or if they never did file a return.
Oh, so after the fact.
Right. Now, Carrie and I tag team each other frequently because he and his organization provide so much help to get people to the point of filing an accurate return. But even if you file an accurate return, there might be problems. First, you might get audited. The IRS might question whether you were truly eligible for the earned income tax credit. Can you prove that this child you claimed lived with you for the requisite number of months? And also, people might not be able to pay the amount that comes due at tax time. And if they can't pay, if things have changed for them, often a medical issue, they might not know that there are options. And if they hear about the clinic, I can help them work something out with the IRS. And then there are those who just haven't paid because they haven't filed for years and years. Maybe they are self-employed workers. Maybe they're actually supposed to be treated as employees, but their company treated them as independent contractors, issuing 1099s and then The worker puts their head in the sand. They don't know what to do. And then the IRS has a way of catching up with people and saying, hey, where's the tax return? And those people can come to me, too.
Interesting. Okay, so you're helping people after the fact.
Yes.
Carrie, you're helping people before the fact,
yes.
You know, sort of lower-income people who might not have access to, you know, high-paid advisors or good advisors. So what sorts of issues are you helping people with this year?
Well, I mentioned earlier the earned income credit is one that is not claimed by a lot of people who are eligible.
Yeah, I heard 20%. Why is that?
Well, because you know, there's no meeting of the people who are eligible who don't file, so we haven't been able to ask them directly. But it's a lot of confusion about things that, for example, they make so little money, they're not required to file a tax return. They don't file at all. But they don't realize that if they are working at all, the earned income credit eligibility kicks in with the very first dollar of earnings. So it could be a few hundred dollars. That's not a lot, but it's nothing to sneeze at.
Sure.
And this confusing definition of, you know, language that the IRS has, like a qualifying child. People think they have to have a child to claim it. You can file a tax return for the earned income credit without a child to claim. And it does not have to be your child. It could be, for example, your younger sibling who is permanently and totally disabled. We had a woman come to one of our tax sites just in that situation. She said, I have filed before myself. If I do it this year with you guys, I'm expecting $1,000 back. She had never claimed her younger sister. She was providing the care for her sister, permanently and totally disabled. They lived together. The older sister was able to get not only the earned income credit for the current year, but we were able to go back 3 years and turn the $1,000 into $10,000.
Oh, my goodness. So that's a significant impact for that family.
And so other factors that qualify, a foster family can claim a foster child for the earned income credit. And with the opioid crisis, seeing so many grandparents raising their grandchildren, those grandparents, if they're working, can also claim their grandchild to get the earned income credit, or grandchildren. It can mean upwards of $6,500 for a family.
I also read that people who claim the earned income tax credit, Carrie, are more likely to be audited.
You know, there's kind of an automatic audit that kicks in early in tax season. All returns that have either the earned income credit or child tax credit are held up from the start of tax season until mid-February. And so it's something that, you know, we've raised some concerns about, but we tell people, come and file early, get that return out of the way. Don't borrow your own money by going to one of those commercial preparers. You'll get the money. It will just be a couple of weeks later. As far as, you know, retirement is concerned for lower income working folks, you know, you've got a 401k if you're lucky. But when 4 in 10 people of all income levels say they couldn't withstand a $400 unexpected expense without having to borrow, it points to this disparity between how do I meet today's obligations, including having enough in the bank so that my next flat tire isn't going to cause me to lose my job, to putting some money aside for retirement. There is a double benefit in the tax code called the Retirement Savers Tax Credit. It allows not only for someone who's working at any income level up to certain parameters to get a tax deduction, essentially, but a credit directly toward their taxes if they're below about $32,000 in income for a single person, $64,000 for a married couple. We see people claiming that accidentally.
Wow. So that's kind of a pat on the back for saying, yes, we recognize your low income. Yes, we recognize that, you know, things are really tight for you. Good job saving. Here's a tax credit.
Exactly. And we see it being claimed at our volunteer income tax sites by people who say, I didn't know I was eligible for this. This is what I mean by accidentally. And I signed a bunch of papers. They gave me a 4-0-something thing and put some money aside. And now we were able to say, now look at this. If you were to put $5 or $10 more per paycheck into this retirement account, this is what it would do for you in terms of still lower taxable income this year, an increased tax credit because it's a kind of a sliding scale of how much you get paid toward your taxes, and most importantly, you are putting some money aside for retirement, which, you know,
that must be very satisfying for you, Carrie, to be able to say to people, hey, look at this for you.
Yeah, exactly. It's some of the most gratifying work I've ever done. The tax preparer who helped that woman get the 3 years worth of earned income credit for $10,000 got the greatest reward or greatest compensation that a volunteer can get, which is a hug from the taxpayer.
Go ahead, Lynn.
Just not today. hugs today.
Concerns, sure.
No, I just wanted to jump in, and a lot of people don't realize, and unless this has changed, that the earned income tax credit is actually a refundable tax credit. So people who wouldn't normally file because they don't have to file could actually get a refund from this credit if they file their tax return. And I think that's kind of where the higher audit level comes in, is because you're actually getting money back that you didn't necessarily pay in.
Right.
So that sort of raises the awareness a little bit on the part of the IRS. That's why people who claim this get audited more often.
All these tax credits are like getting a gift card to pay your taxes.
Sure.
So some are non-refundable. It pays the tax bill down to zero. Any money left on that card goes away. But as Lynn points out, a refundable credit means after that tax bill is paid, you actually get a refund in cash of the remaining amount.
I want to ask you all about a couple more biggies that might have seen some changes. First off, Lynn, housing. The mortgage interest deduction still exists. How much did that go away under the 2017 overhaul? I know it didn't go away, but it changed.
It didn't go away. It really comes into that whole whether or not you're eligible for an itemized deduction. But they've also kind of capped out what you can take for certain things. With the tax, one of the tax extenders they did, they actually have allowed mortgage interest premium deductions again. But again, you still have to be able to file that itemized deduction as opposed to the standard deduction.
So if you want these benefits, you have to go through the hassle of itemizing.
Yes.
And you might not end up getting them, but you have to see.
Right. And they put certain caps on for people who have very expensive homes that they have mortgaged, that they can only deduct a certain percentage, a certain level of the interest that they pay because of the amount of the loan that they take, so the interest is higher. So they've changed that a little bit, which have gotten people getting a little creative. Instead of filing married, they just don't get married, and then they can each get the deduction so they can get the interest off. And again, it's one of those things that's kind of working around, but that's more of a problem for people who have houses that have a mortgage of $1 million or more.
Okay.
So it's...
Lynn, how about the property tax limit?
So that was a big deal, too.
That's right. There's also a property tax limit as well, and some towns have started to get kind of creative in trying to make it so that you used to be able to deduct everything that you paid for real estate taxes. Now they've capped it at, I believe, $10,000. So some towns have gotten a little bit creative, especially here in New Hampshire, because we have such high real estate tax rates. Some towns were trying to make it so that you could deduct as a charitable contribution to the town, even though it's a tax, and it kind of got a little crazy. The courts all shot that down.
So it used to be that you could deduct state and local taxes off of your federal taxes. That got limited, and that caused an outcry here in New Hampshire because people liked deducting those property taxes from their federal
Correct. And a lot of those people that had the outcry are actually now subject to the standard deduction anyway, so it was kind of a moot point. But, you know, people love getting their deductions.
Well,
so.
And change is always complicated.
It is.
You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. What about health care expenses? I know that changed the last time around in the big 2017 overhaul. This year, I heard that there's a lower floor for people to deduct medical expenses, 7.5% of income instead of, I think, 10%. Anybody know the status of medical expenses and what people who might have big medical bills in a particular year can do?
So it goes back to if you're itemizing.
If you're itemizing. That's the big if
right.
of this conversation
you can
today.
Claim medical expenses that are above 7.5% of your income.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, doing the math, that's, you know, gives you a little bit better than the 10%. So if you made $100,000 last year and at the 10% level, that means you could claim a deduction of the amount over $10,000. You know, if you're having $10,000 in medical expenses, there's some other concerns. And so if folks say they don't qualify for that, we say, okay, that's good. You know, now it becomes a $7,500 floor, and the amount above that is what's deductible, again, if folks itemize. Another important change with regard to health care is if you did not have health insurance during 2019, you are no longer having to pay this so-called shared responsibility payment.
Right. I remember that was controversial, and they took it out of this, which caused a whole uproar in terms of the Affordable Care Act and so forth, but we're not going to talk about
about that today. Last question, Barbara, to you. How can people avoid getting bad advice? Because it seems like a lot of folks are going to need some advice.
Yeah, that's an excellent question and a tough one to answer. One of the best resources for good information about tax return preparers is the IRS website, irs.gov, but also, as Carrie had mentioned, the New Hampshire Society for CPAs and the Northern New England Society for Enrolled Agents. And we have Lynn here and her colleagues, too. And just do your research. Don't assume that just because your buddy down the road used his uncle, that his uncle is necessarily going to do a good job on your return.
All right. All of you, thank you very much. There's a lot more we could have talked about. Barbara, it was good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Good to see you, too, Laura.
Barbara Hagee, coordinator and staff attorney of the Low Income Taxpayer Project. Lynn Ford, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Lynn Ford, vice president and wealth manager at the Charter Trust Company. And Carrie Gladstone, always nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Always good to be with you.
Carrie Gladstone, senior director of asset building strategies at Granite United Way. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.